You're listening to Go Fish with Mike Buck on AM 690, The Fishing Answer. This segment is being brought to you by the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council at wpcouncil.org. Now, troll on in.
You know, specifically troll on in if you're after stripies. You know, a few weeks ago, Dr. Mark Fitchett and I were talking about stripies, talking about marlin in general and all the pelagics. And today, it's a bonus day because, as you know, we all love the stripies, and they're in controversy. Are the stocks plentiful? What makes them different from some of the other marlin, the other pelagics that are around? And it just so happens that Mark Fitchett has a cast of thousands today. We're almost going to give you your own parking stall because we've been having you on lately, and we really enjoy it. So you do the pelagic fishery studies. Let's talk a little bit about our special guests today, both of them, so you can introduce them. Both have been on the show before, and we're going to talk about marlin with people, stripies with people that know them. How did this all happen?
Well, council has been interested in striped marlin and building a tagging program. Mm. For stripers for some time, and striped marlin are interesting species, being that the stock structure is kind of equivocal. There's been some genetic work that suggests that we might have a local mature stock here, but then tagging studies, as Molly and Tim will talk about shortly, have showed that these things can stay from here and go all the way to Coral Sea. The residency of these things are kind of unknown.
Well, you know, I can tell you, and it's through this program that people have learned over the last 3 or 4 years, that first of all, that we have a indigenous local yellowfin tuna, that we might have big eye, you know, and I know it's always up for contradiction but we also didn't know that maybe we have, we thought that all pelagic game, surface running game fish just happened to stop by Hawaii, that not that they lived here, but this is indicative that stripies are living here?
Well, I would say on the contrary, we might have some fish that show some residency or some natal homing, but then we don't necessarily know. And that's why it's important here. We have Tim and Molly. As we discussed last week, we think that the growth structure of these fish have some regional differences, and that we need a better life history.
Depends on where you are. You go faster in one place, slower.
And maturity. Things are there's a lot of equivocal assumptions that are being made in stock assessments. So having Tim and Molly here are great, and having them do their work so we can look at movement rates and residency of striped marlin, because these are the foremost experts in pelagic tagging work. So
and Molly's been here before. Dr. Letkovich has been before. I think it's great that we have you here again, Molly, and just to show not just the reach that we have at the council, but you can't be further away from Hawaii than where you are sometimes. So you've been here all the way from, and we talk about Gloucester, and we talk about the East all the time, but isn't that amazing that the expertise that you've gathered is now being sought after and needed in places like Hawaii? Here you are again.
Here we are again. Yeah. We've actually been here about 14 years when I was on the SSC, but there's so many interesting parallels between Atlantic and Pacific tunas and marlins, and we're just applying the scientific tools and our relationships with fishermen here. So it's been a great place.
What I love is this. Mark mentioned it earlier. This tagging program, I mean, a lot of people, I think it's just so phenomenal when something gets seen where it, like, hey, this fish is not supposed to be here. The tag is from Hawaii. And you've talked about major expanses of ocean that these things, that they will traverse.
Yeah, if you remember when we talked about the tuna tagging, the ahi tagging, everyone thought, oh, they're local fish, and we assume from other kinds of data that they're local. But the first pilot study we've had, and really just within 60 days, two of the elephant or the ahi that our fishermen partners tagged were halfway across the Pacific on their way to San Diego.
Okay, I'm wondering if this is good, bad, or ugly when it comes time to determine what we have. In other words, if, like I said, and maybe incorrectly, but evidence had led more people to at least say for a while, Mark, that yellowfin tuna are specific to, we have a yellowfin tuna stocked specific to here, and that's why you see the little babies.
And some of the tagging work in the prior have shown a long duration of residency here. There could have been in those tagging studies, like in any tagging study, you know, there's some biases based on seasonality and things like that. But it's good to get more and more information, more genetic information, looking at gene flow versus fish flow. These are important things, and Molly and Tim are here and doing really good work to help answer some of those questions.
Yeah, and incidentally, Dr. Tim Lamb, who's been here before too, is a research scientist at PIFG as well, but at the University of Massachusetts and in Boston. How long have you been in the business, Doc?
Quite a while. I think I've been doing pelagic work since 2004 and like been in two oceans, worked on stripies, tunas, anything that moves. So
yeah, and that's what I like about it. And I'm guessing that all of this expertise come in. It's sort of hard, Mark, to develop the expertise here. We have scholarships, we have things that we do talk about. But isn't it kind of neat when people like yourself and others, all three of the whole panel today, really came from far, far away to end up using their experience and their mana here in Hawaii.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. And I think there's a lot of Hawaii is a unique place. It's going to be attractive to a lot of great minds because of the ecosystem here. And here we have folks from all over the world that convene in Hawaii. It's a strategic location. It's a lot of, as my boss, Kitty Simons, at Westpac would say, is the capital of the Pacific.
Yeah, yeah. We consider ourselves the peak or the belly button of the world. That's right. What we But interestingly enough, I think, and some of you have heard, many of you have heard, are different variations of the Wicked Tuna Guys. And when we talk about Gloucester, that's what we're talking about, Molly's hunting grounds. As a matter of fact, you have experience with a lot of those guys. Here we all think there's like six boats, but there are really literally hundreds that are limited by these seasons, correct?
That's correct. And as we know, Wicked Tuna is a form of entertainment.
Oh, of course it is.
But the diversity of the Atlantic Bluefin Fleet in the U.S. and Canada is pretty amazing, and it's been a real joy for us to work with them. Tim and I have had a lot of fun tagging with our fishermen, giant bluefin, and we're doing the same here for big tunas. Yeah.
When you tag a giant bluefin, let's make sure that people understand, at what age are you tagging them?
We tag what we call the tinies, the babies.
Yeah, the babes.
And we tag fish all the way from fish large enough to carry a tag, and all the way up to the giants, up to 1,000 pounds,
wow,
the granders.
Yeah. Boy, hard to let those go. Ooh. but you know, that's what I bring it up. And I think maybe, I think I asked both of you about this once before, but what I'm amazed at in the show, when they know they have a short, I mean, it's supposed to be 73 inches, right, in that fishery. And if they have one that's 70, they can tell. And I mean, I'm thinking, they usually look bigger to me. I'm not sure you can really tell. But what I want to know is, Tim, you get this one. What if they inadvertently keep a fish that's a short? What happens to them? Do they get fined? Do they get tagged? What happens to somebody that breaks that rule?
Well, if they have tags, they do tag and release, and we definitely encourage that. But if they do land it, you get fined. So, like, it's under strict regulations, and everything has to operate by the book. So, and the U.S. fisherman has been really good at following regulations, and so it's
As you both know, and I think Molly, we talked about this last time around. Our longline fleet in Hawaii is the most observed anywhere. I mean, you know, you're going to have an observer. You got to do the rules. Some of the equipment and some of the releasing and some of the stuff that's taking place is because of this microscope that this 128 boat fleet is under, you know, with respect to doing the right thing.
That's right. And we've witnessed for a long time the innovation and the ideas that fishermen have brought to the table to greatly reduce and mitigate bycatch. And so fishermen rarely get the credit for that, but a lot of those techniques were developed by fishermen on the high seas and by longliners.
Let's talk, Mark, about stripies, because, you know, we discovered that we have this mutual love and admiration and hunger for stripies because they taste so good. Where are we? I mean, you know, we're at a point in time when I know some of our commercial guys are concerned because they're not able to sell fish like they used to. What is the big convergence on stripies about right now? What are we looking at stripies specifically for?
Well, right now there's three big topics. The one right now is the Billfish Conservation Act that we discussed in prior shows that prohibits any movement of billfish product into the mainland U.S. It has to stay in Hawaii. And it's creating some economic hardship also with the market for billfish here. And a lot of folks feel in Hawaii feel like they're being kind of bullied politically. And so that's one component. The other issue is the stock is going to be subjected to a rebuilding plan. The Western Central Pacific Fisheries Commission met in December, and they've been at the science committee for the commission for since 2011 has been suggesting the stock, because of it's in decline.
Mm-hmm.
A rebuilding plan needs to be suggested. So this year, some delegations, foreign delegations, finally said, okay, we need to do a rebuilding plan now. However, there's a stock assessment pending this year. And in prior...
The dreaded stock assessment, right?
The dreaded stock
assessment. So much depends on these numbers.
It does depend. And the scientists who are working on it are phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the best in the world, but I would argue that some of the information that they have on, you know, life history and the biology of the fish is missing in the central northern Pacific, including movement, including maturity and age and growth. And as we
one thing you did talk about,
yeah.
And I want to make sure that people understand it. We're not talking about a small difference in the growth rates, or they sometimes can be large. And so, right. and unless you've really done a long enough study. And study that is definitive by people that are not predetermined what they're going to find, their objective in their research, that it becomes more valuable. Don't we have a delegation, or we thought we did, trying to get an exception so that there can be some billfish caught in Hawaii, sold on the mainland?
There are some folks here, well, so going back to the first part,
yeah.
the policy, the politics, there is now some push here.
Mm.
To maybe revert some of these decisions made on the Billfish Conservation Act.
Okay.
I know council's been very vocal about this because, you know, whether or not the billfish there being finding its way or leaking. So the argument was that billfish were leaking into the marketplace from Hawaii, which is absurd. You know, every fish from Hawaii comes with a piece of paper, as we discussed in the last show.
The old paper trail.
And there's a lot of
right
fish,
where it came from. Who caught it, when they caught it, all that stuff.
And there's a lot of products that are either mislabeled coming in, even from Florida, and the markets there coming from Central America. So where there's little oversight. So the argument from council and from the from the fishing industry here is that, well, you're creating an argument that doesn't exist.
I've seen some of that on the Wicked Tuna things, but I'm wondering both to Tim Lamb and Molly. Tim, have you heard the expression before, tailpipe ahi?
Mm.
Okay, what about you, Molly?
Yeah, I have.
Okay, and that simply means fish that is caught some faraway place and then gassed to make the color look fresher or oily or what, or all of the above?
Yeah, well, we know that a lot of tuna that comes onto the American, in the grocery stores and the marketplace, comes from elsewhere.
Right.
Marshall Islands, South Pacific, despite the availability and the really good quality of the local fish. And so the really pink tuna that you see for sale in some places has been subjected for preservation for carbon monoxide.
Yeah,
and other things.
And that's why they call it tailpipe tuna. And it's almost like an exhaust pipe, but not quite. It's better carbon dioxide that they use. But one of the other things, Mark, that I think is really important, and you mentioned something, and I think maybe the audience might have missed it, but when you talk about being impactful for the local sale of billfish, it means if you take away the demand from, say, the mainland U.S., that means the value is decreased because all of it stays here, and there's going to be more caught than the market wants. Therefore, the price is going to be, instead of $8 or $9 or $10 a pound, $2 or $3 a pound. Big problem.
Yeah, and you're going to have a surplus of fish, a surplus of product. And so that does hit the pocketbook of some of your fishermen here. And then, you know, but so the argument is, well, is the amount of striped marlin being harvested here significant and compared to foreign fishing is another issue. So what are we going to accomplish, relatively speaking, you know, with harvest and exploitation and post-catch mortality or sorry, incidental mortality of stripers and foreign fleets?
Well, I would imagine that if a stripey is caught in years past, when it has value, that it's going to not be taking up too much ice and not being in the way of a longer range boat. But for the short range guys, they go out and they catch a fresh fish. They've got to handle it themselves to get it cold enough to go even get delivered to the auction. So there's a lot of things. And if they're not going to get the money that they used to get,
right,
you can understand what they might be.
And if it's caught locally here, it's going to get eaten versus dumped overboard or chopped up and used as and some other means. Right. So
let's find out what this trio is up to right now. Molly, you live a lot of the time on Kauai.
I do, in Lihue.
In Lihue. And what are you doing right now? What's your project?
Our projects are following the results from the tags that we have out there on big eye tuna in both oceans and striped marlins, of course. Writing proposals to find more funding to do more work.
Which
and
is, I know, that's a big ongoing monkey on your back to find the money. One thing about tagging, when somebody catches a tagged fish, this is great if they know what to do with it. But do people also report so that we know how many fish are tagged, even if they haven't been picked up? Do you see that? Do fishermen come in and say, we tagged 5 big eyes this day?
Yeah, and that's the partnership that we have ongoing with PIFG. So they have been a champion in promoting the tag and releases, and through the networks and relationship at the auction or the fleets, that we get lots of reports back on like some of these just basic information. And that's why we really love working here, because like even though it's a big ocean, a small landmass, we have all these people who are aware and want to participate. And that's how we started with the ahi tagging, and also how we get the stripies going too.
It really shows you the commitment that's been made by the PIFG, because you know, I know a lot of times, Molly, and I know you've overcome this, and particularly because you're here a lot on Kauai, is that it's finally to a point where a lot of our fishermen, the commercial guys that were maybe close to the vessel, their information, are sharing a little bit more, because it hasn't come back to bite them. In some cases, their quotas actually increase, which they say, yes, because we participated. So this ongoing relationship you have, you actually, I'm guessing you need. It's not a nice to have. You need to have it.
Absolutely, and it goes back to what Mark was talking about. Most fishermen are businessmen now, and they realize that the issues that Mark brought up about the nature of the central north of, you know, Hawaiian fish, where do they, who do they belong to? Are they connected? Because the management and the assessments affect them and their pocketbook. So they want to know what are the yearly migration routes of the fish and what's the relationship of the main Hawaiians to elsewhere in the Pacific.
So I'm guessing that we have somewhere a great grid map, and that we have all of these squiggly lines, which we're supposed to show where fish come and when fish go. Isn't it, because of science, a lot better now than it used to be? Because I remember back in the day when everybody used to wait for the big eye to come or the ahi to come, and they all thought that all those fish were coming from some Japan current somewhere and stopping off here so we could catch some, and they're moving on to somewhere else. Isn't that kind of what does happen?
I mean, so the Kuroshito current coming from Japan is important. That's going to help fish move with currents and for feeding and things. But, you know, a lot of tagging studies show that, you know, we have some mixing of a lot of the tunas, particularly big eye tuna. I think Molly in her recent research can speak more of yellowfin, showing that these fish come from the EPO. There's a lot of heavy residency in the Central Pacific. There's been talk about a Central Pacific yellowfin stock. And then for striped marlin, on the other hand, which is a completely different animal, we're managed sort of a central, western, northern Pacific stock, which there's an invisible line.
I always love this, because I always talk to these scientists. The invisible line is super invisible to the fish.
Right.
They have no idea what the grid they're in.
And the equator. There may be considerable fish flow from here south of the equator to the EPO. There's a lot of, which is the Eastern Pacific, when I say EPO, but there's fish that we found tags, even some of the conventional tags from the 80s and 90s that are moving between California.
Amazing, huh? Yeah.
So
they're still alive. So they're not getting all great whited to death, are they? incidentally, I think it's kind of cool, because if we have this combined expertise, same thing with you, Tim. What was it that got you this particular opportunity to be part of this study?
The striped marlin is a very interesting case in terms of knowledge that's missing. The last real tagging work was ended in 2006. So we have 10 years.
Yeah, no tags for all those years.
Right? Yeah, so 10-year gap. And that's when Molly and I decided we got to pick this up again, because no one's looking, and all the issues that even before then, we know it will come to be haunting when you have such a lack of time series and data sets. So how we started.
And Molly, it's kind of neat, because we talked a little bit before about writing grants and getting the money. And I'm guessing that some of the questions would be to somebody that was going to come up with the money. Okay, how many fish can you tag? And what are you going to do with all of this stuff? Why should we invest in this? Let's talk about that for a little bit, because Tim sounded concerned that we haven't had a stripey tagging thing for a while. So this means hopefully that we can get some of our listeners, some of our fishermen, to find out where to get tags and start tagging and start reporting.
Well, absolutely. PIFG has focused on the reasons for tagging, but we'd also like to point out that the number of what we call these data loggers, fishery independent tags, that are so important and so valuable and so very expensive.
Yeah.
The challenge for all of us is that the numbers of tags that have been deployed here in Hawaii and the territories are a drop in the bucket, and the diversity of the migration paths of the fish that we can only learn best with independent data loggers. Yeah. We really have to put out a lot of tags, as we have in the Atlantic for bluefin, until we get the whole story. And that's going to take quite a while and a lot of work together.
What is quite a while in scientists speak?
Oh, quite
a decade?
Well, for example, bluefin tuna, it's probably taken 2 decades to really rout out all of the information that people suspect, fishermen suspected, but the evidence wasn't in hand. And that's why we're here. We really thought, this work has to be done here in the Hawaiian Islands, and should be done here because of the importance of these pelagic fishes.
And that we fish all year round and a lot of these other things. I think, Mark, what's interesting to me, and not just about this particular tagging, but we are so observed and we're so looked at that having this inner cooperation is pretty good. So I know that, and we've talked with guys like Roy Morioka and all of these other guys that are bottom guys that tag the bottom and then let the fish go. It's a pretty hard deal to let a nice big onaga go free when that's what you're trying to catch the next day. But don't we see a growing number of these guys that are saying, all right, in order to have something for tomorrow, we have to give of today? How many times can we go to the well with guys like Uncle Roy and Ed and some of these other guys?
There's a lot of folks here in the troll fishery as well who are more than willing. I have a friend of mine in Eva Beach who would love to cooperate on some of the billfish tagging. We have McGrew Rice, who's a council, he's part of the council family in Kona.
And I got to tell you all something. I got to interrupt you because I love this. Every year, most every year, I'm the MC of the HIBT, and of course I work with McGrew and with everybody up there, and my dear lifelong friend Peter Fithian, and this is a contest. But in many respects, at the end of the day, what used to be really exciting is gone because they tag everything, virtually everything. And that means for a big game tournament guy, it's like, okay, you got the picture, you got the tag, let it go. And every now and again, it's amazing. And I'm going to pre-guess both to Mark and to Molly and to you, as a matter of fact, that every now and again, when a fish has been tagged, it's been tagged more than once. And, you know, sometimes there's a couple of tags on it. That means the fish hasn't learned a lesson. He's still hungry for that. But how does that work into the big picture? How helpful is it to know, for instance, when you get a fish that was tagged 6 years ago?
Yeah, I think a lot of information can come from that time period. We know how big they were. And after so many years, that's how big they after. Yeah. So that piece of information with growth rates is humongous. Yeah. It's great for Mark to run his models. Assessment depends on it. Everything comes from the biology. That even that simple act of getting a tag back 5 years later, 6 years later, gives us that key information. So reporting the link from the different time points is key.
Yeah, and you know, when we learn that in the bottom tagging, which we'll get into at another time, but I still want to make sure that we understand through Tim and Molly, Mark, that we are kind of a valuable place to be able to do this for the number of reasons that was already talked about, not just the year-round weather and everything else, but the presence of the fish. So this particular go-around of the striped marlin that you're talking about, how is it working right now? How many guys are, through PIFG, are out there willing to participate, have the tags on their boat, and are doing it?
Well, we're mostly in the Striped Marlin Project, which was funded by NOAA.
Right.
We are mostly working right now with longliners because, of course, they have the most access to
and the geography that they're covering.
And the geography. Yeah. And there are others that are deploying conventional tags as well as the Striped Marlin. And I hope Tim will get to mention, for example, one of the most exciting migration records that we have. But so we have how many? Maybe at least 10 captains and crews for
that's
both the
wonderful
satellite tagging and conventional tagging, probably more.
Mm-hmm. That's terrific. To that, Tim, you know, I almost want to say that I get giddy when I hear it because, and I'm not in your field, but I know that if I want to rely on what you all do, you have to be given absolutely every bit of help that you can from outside that, right?
Yeah, and that's why we love the team. And one of the early results that we had on Stripe is that one long migration from Hawaii all the way to Brisbane, Australia, just off the coast. And
that's amazing.
And that thing is like unheard of. No one has even thought about it. All the previous work has been showing the fish are staying around Hawaii. We were the first one who are lucky enough, just wherever it is, we are happy that the fish are delivering the results right away from the first few tags that we put out. And
you know, Molly, one thing that you should address that people understand, everybody sort of knows how a long line works, how they set and how they soak and then they come back. A lot of the tuna are either dead or almost dead when they're doing it. What about, what's interesting about when a long liner gets a stripey and can release it and tag it? Do they have the pension? Can they stay alive a little bit longer? Why are we so lucky to be able to have them live after being hooked?
Well, what we've learned over the years, it's actually that longline fish can be really good candidates because they're still alive. Mm-hmm. In fact, a lot of our Atlantic Big Eye and tuna tagging was done with longliners.
Yeah, yeah.
And here we know that because they're alive on the hook and basically their physiology is still in somewhat in the normal range for some of them.
They're kind of upset because they got a hook in their mouth.
Well, but, I should say the survivorship of almost all of the tags that we put out show extremely low post-release mortality.
That's amazing, isn't it? Don't you think?
And it's also, you're right, it's the skill of the captain and crew of selecting these, you know, for $4,000 tag, but in the case of bluefin and big eye in the Atlantic, we had almost zero indication of post-release mortality of the fish that they tagged. But the one thing we do see in the Pacific is a lot more predation of fish that are released maybe weeks later. So it's not because they were caught, but there's a lot of critters out there like false killers and others biting them.
Yeah, that's amazing, you know. And I don't know if they've been slowed down. I don't know if you've seen some of the tags on some of the big fish, Mark. They're like, they're heavy. They're big things. But they must just like, you put them on the, and off they go. It's pretty interesting.
Yeah, and they're pretty hardy. Yeah. And also, you know, a lot of the longline caught fish here, particularly billfish, they're caught during gear haulback. So they're able at least to have somewhat of a green fish. And so we're hoping that, you know, if there is some measures made to keep the fish alive and to tag and release them, that they'll stay green and pretty healthy. And we saw the same with sailfish in the Eastern Pacific. We put these tags on. We use the smallest tags we can find.
Sure.
Sailfish are not as hardy as a marlin, but we found tag retention has been very good and very little mortality rates. Whereas we call them mud darts. They make these 3,000-meter dives. You know.
Well, that's the other thing. I mean, we've often touched bases with some of the ground fisher, bottom fishermen, and the technique in which they use to bring the fish up is important. If they're going to keep it, it's not as important because, you know, if it dies, it dies. But what they're talking about is sometimes taking a one of these deep seven, you know, off the bottom and bringing it up too quickly, the fish is not going to make it, you know. Okay, so, but I still want to make sure that we dot the I's and cross the T's on these stripies because it is a favorite fish here, Tim, and I know that I can tell just by talking to you that you kind of like them too. But I still want to make sure that people understand that it's not really easy to go out. You got to find them, you got to catch them, you got to tag them, you got to keep records of them. I'm amazed that these projects even keep going. You know what I mean, Mark?
Yeah, and I agree. And sometimes even if you do it right, the fish may not show you what they want to show you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And that will harm us in a way. If we don't show some new stuff, then someone will come back and say, why you keep doing it? But we believe in the fish. We believe in the group that we work with. We know there's so many unanswered questions. So I think that's kind of, you have to give some time and keep doing it.
Well, I can tell you that a lot of the commercials that we've done, I've done a couple of television commercials on catch and release. It is a real thing practiced by a lot of people. And even though, and Molly, I know that the big thrill in the reality shows coming from your neck of the woods are the weigh-ins and the core samples and all of this stuff. I'm going to get you $23 a pound for this. But when you go to a tournament and everybody coming in off the tournament is there for a photo, and they're holding the rod, and they're holding the lure. but there's no fish because the fish got tagged and released. This must still be a very important part of people buying into to doing that, because if we don't do that, then there's nothing for you all to study.
You're absolutely right, but I can tell you all these years we've seen what fishermen want most after their investment of releasing is to see what they did in the data. It's like Christmas when you show them the data. And that's why I think everybody's so jazzed that's even more important, because they'll say, what happened to that fish over a year? And they get insights. They probably knew a lot of it, but they get some good information.
What would some of those things be? I mean, you know, Tim, you mentioned earlier that sometimes it's, you know, when a fish is tagged, if it's done properly, you kind of guess how big it is and all that stuff. And when you see it 5 years later, it could be three times as big as it used to be. That's very valuable, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, totally. Because that's kind of the ground truth. Like, we can do a lot of modeling and exercise, but it's not the real data. So unless we get real data, like, we can model wherever.
But the other side of it, Tim, is what comes off a long line catch when you get relatively a green fish is that when somebody's going to look at tagging, when a stripey, say, breaks the water, and you think, I'm going to tag this one, you know, you still have to use a much better sense on drag and tension and how you bring that fish in. Because if you kill it, if you tag it and you think it's okay and you release it, it's of no value.
And also going with what Molly and Tim are saying, is that every tag tells a story and you get this data back and you're trying to build biological abstractions or realistic inferences on the behavior, then extrapolate that to a bigger picture. And sometimes, you know, based on what story you tell, you can make it a self-fulfilling prophecy. But one of the things I like about Tim and Molly is that they're able to do really good science, explain very specific reasoning for movements, and they're very honest about the caveats and limitations, but make very good assumptions. And I think that is very extremely valuable for having scientists like Molly and Tim here working with us to really show realistic pictures of movement of fish and continuing the work and doing a very well designed sampling of tagging. So if you tag a bunch of fish in one area in one season, you may have some biases. And one thing that Molly and Tim are good at is identifying those.
So. Yeah, and I'm blown away at where they run away from. I can't wait till we can talk and maybe some more. One thing that I do know for both Molly and Tim, when we have the Papio tagging project, people get through because their name is in it, you know, and you get a guy that's tagged 50 fish this year. I guess that isn't that part of the pride that is developed by the fishermen that you're dealing with, and they know that they're contributing to the future way more than just passing on that one fish.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And the social networking is part of it.
Yeah. So anyway, I'm so glad that we could spend some time together. It just the planets sort of lined up. Tim, what's next for you? How much longer are you going to be around?
I'm just here. My mom's coming over for some vacations. Oh, that's sticking around. But Molly's here for quite a bit of the year, so she'll be keep working on.
So in other words, you're back to Boston.
Yes.
Exactly. Wear a jacket. I mean, what? How cold did it get?
I think it's like in the minus 10.
Yeah. and you know, we talk about the resilience, Molly, and the strength and the seafaredness of the Gloucester guys. But I mean, this thing had to have been just even hammered that. What do you hear from home?
We try not to talk to people at home because they're very unhappy with us being out here.
Yeah, I bet.
So, but I know Tim didn't mention the other thing is we get our bluefin tuna research stuff lined up and get ready for bluefin season.
Yeah.
So when he's back in Gloucester and Massachusetts, right, he's got to do that. Yeah.
Well, that was great. Molly, nice seeing you. And thanks for coming in. Same, Tim Lamb, thank you. We'll see you again. And Martin's going to be, you're going to be back in next week. Huh?
Yeah.
Like I said, we're going to get you your own parking space.
All right.
If you all want to hear something on the show, you know what to do. Drop me a line, themikebuckshow@gmail.com. themikebuckshow@gmail.com. And all of the stuff that we're talking about, particularly this product, is available right now at wpcouncil.org. wpcouncil.org, great resource, especially for you teachers and stuff out there. And get into that and explain how proud you are of a fisherman that's going to actually tag something instead of bag it. Okay? We'll see you next time. Have a good weekend. Aloha.